This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this show on Free Speech TV nationwide and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates. Donald Trump signed an executive order last Friday on U.S.-Cuba policy, attempting to reverse all the progress made under President Obama toward the island nation that had long been considered a pariah by the U.S. Just as Cuba's tourism industry was expecting to grow from U.S. tourists, the Trump order places restrictions on travel once again. Trump also reiterated the long-standing trade embargo on Cuba, which Obama never formally lifted. Trump justified his orders saying, quote, "We must ensure that U.S. funds are not channeled to a regime that has failed to meet the most basic requirements of a free and just society." Cuban officials lashed back, calling the move hostile and saying that the U.S. was in, quote, "no condition to lecture us." My guest is Netfa Freeman with the Institute for Policy Studies. He's an organizer at the International Committee for Peace, Justice, and Dignity and has worked in the U.S.-Cuba solidarity movement for a long time. Welcome to the program, Netfa.
Thank you, Sonali.
So first, before we get to what Trump is trying to undo, can you summarize what it was that Obama actually did? I mean, he kept the main part of the problematic U.S.-Cuba relation, which is the trade embargo, in place. But he did actually resume diplomatic ties, right?
So the Obama administration, what they did was reopen negotiations to normalize relations, to consider normalizing the relations. And then they were also trying to figure out what measures, what kind of demands that the United States, well, not demands, but things the United States was requesting in terms of influences and changes in Cuban society, what Cubans would also negotiate with. Some of those things, well, one thing that the Obama administration did here on the U.S. side was open up travel restrictions. So individual people-to-people exchanges were opened up. And then also certain things like behind-the-scenes things that people don't think about was the fact that they were in negotiation for things like looking at the details of how to reestablish things like a postal service, because before you couldn't just send mail to Cuba through the U.S. Postal Service to go to Cuba. So individual things like that.
So what exactly did Trump's executive order decide, or you know, what did it spell out in terms of undoing Obama's advances on U.S.-Cuba policy? This was a big campaign promise that he made when he was campaigning for president. And on Friday, he spoke in front of a very enthusiastic audience about what he was going to do. But beyond the rhetoric, what does his executive order actually spell out? And can he actually completely undo what Obama did?
Well, it didn't completely undo what Obama did. In fact, very little. So there were 11 stipulations in which people can, 12, that people can travel to Cuba with. And then, so he only really changed one of them. And that was the one I just talked about, the people to people, individual people to people travel versus group travel. Because groups can go under certain auspices, under the OFAC, the Office of Foreign Assets and Control, the Treasury Department, which manages the travel. Not only that, they actually administer a lot of the sanctions or the blockade against Cuba. And then, so the individual travel was ceased, and that's only ceased for people who didn't already have plans and had tickets booked and all that kind of stuff. So if you already had that, you can still go. But no new acceptances will be made in terms of licenses for individuals. Now, group travel is still intact, but you have to comply with a whole set of, a set of record keeping, and you have to keep records for 5 years, and you can only go if you don't, educational excursion that doesn't apply to getting a degree for whatever it is, and then also cannot have so much contact with the government officials. And so that still is intact. And then also on the business side, he's made restrictions in terms of any company doing business. You have to be, and this is maybe a difficult one for people. Companies that do businesses with any entities in Cuba that have connections to the military or to Cuban intelligence Cuban intelligence, Secret Service, I think. And so security services, intelligence, and the military. And so that's actually almost 60% of the entities in Cuba because of the country being so tied up with state apparatuses. And so that's a very ambiguous one, and that might really hamper a lot of the business community. But there are so many other things that, in terms of like the one, which is actually a positive thing, he didn't talk about breaking ties, diplomatic ties, which is very interesting. And so it's not a complete rollback, as he said. He claimed it was like a complete turnaround, but it wasn't. And I think in this instance, it wasn't because it's a very unpopular move, even among Republicans, even among his own party. There are a lot of people who were favoring the move toward normalizing relations and business of the community, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, so many of them, and even a large portion of Cuban Americans were in favor of normalized relations. So what Trump has done, and so that's one of the reasons why he couldn't do a complete about face, because he's actually having to deal with the unpopularity of it. So he only did a little bit.
I want to actually play for you and our audience some excerpts of the speech that Trump made on Friday when he signed the executive order. Here is what he had to say.
Therefore, effective immediately, I am canceling the last administration's completely one-sided deal with Cuba. Our new policy begins with strictly enforcing U.S. law. We will not lift sanctions on the Cuban regime until all political prisoners are freed. Freedoms of assembly and expression are respected. All political parties are legalized. And free and internationally supervised elections are scheduled. We will very strongly restrict American dollars flowing to the military, security, and intelligence services that are the core of the Castro regime. They will be restricted. We will enforce the ban on tourism. We will enforce the embargo. We will take concrete steps to ensure that investments flow directly to the people so they can open private businesses and begin to build their country's great, great future, a country of great potential.
And that's Donald Trump speaking on Friday upon the signing of his executive order to, quote, cancel Obama's progress on U.S.-Cuba relations. Much to discuss there. He mentioned political prisoners, which is really interesting because I know, Netfa, you've worked on the story of the Cuban Five, who were Cuban That's political right. prisoners here in the U.S., and it took a lot of work to free them. But it was interesting to hear Trump talk about freedom of assembly and expression and the need for those to be respected, as well as free and internationally supervised elections. Something which he doesn't hold some of his favorite other countries to those standards, such as, say, Saudi Arabia, right?
Right. I mean, not even just Saudi Arabia. Here in the United States, there's such misinformation about elections. If we were to compare elections in the United States, we have so much information coming out, news exposing things like voter suppression and riggings and the fact that even people who run, and when you get up to the level of president especially, you can only run if you have a lot of big money backing you. That's the only thing. And then the fact that only the Republican and Democratic parties are really allowed to participate freely in the election. There's so much done to derail any manifestation or showing of any other party. And so that's just the election side in Cuba, a lot of people do. And then here you have things like laws that disenfranchise people who've been incarcerated. People have to register. They do a lot of redistricting things and all that kind of stuff. And in Cuba, you're eligible to vote as soon as you're at age 16. And people don't realize that. Cuba actually enjoys a participation rate of in their elections of anything between 85 and 90 some percent. That means 85 to 90 some percent of the people participate in the electoral processes they have. That's here, amazing. The kind of propaganda you get about Cuba, you would think they don't have elections at all. Now, they only have one party, that's the Communist Party, but that doesn't have a play in the election process. Mm-hmm. And people don't, and when they're running on the local, municipal, and provincial levels, they're not running as a person of the Communist Party. You don't have to be a Communist Party member to run in the elections. There's no big money involved in it. Everyone has equal access to things like the debates and the campaigning avenues and things like that. And then what's something that a lot of people don't realize, the National Assembly of Cuba, which is would be the equivalent of the Congress here in the United States, actually not just has representation from geographical people representing geographical regions, but also people representing sectors of society like women and youth and workers. And that's like something, to me, that's much more democratic. And then just the fact that people are highly educated, which is it's a big achievement. It has to have an impact when it comes to democracy, the level of democracy there. Here, there's so much people we don't even have any say in who's nominated. Now, there are other differences, like with the president, for example, the National Assembly elects the president. And so they're not directly elected by the people, but the people do directly elect the National Assembly representatives and the representatives on the levels underneath that. And so if, in fact, they wanted to have a different president, they would be able to. Another thing that Cuba enjoys that the U.S. doesn't enjoy is the right to national referendums. In the United States, there's no such thing, and only some states have the right to referendum, so you're actually able to vote on policies and things that affect your lives. And so those are really crazy things. The right to assembly, these are things. One, a lot of people need to know that some of the laws, the Helms-Burton Law and the Torricelli Act that enforce the blockade, and then other programs that are orchestrated by the U.S. Agency for International Development and the CIA and whatnot, actually employ people in Cuba, Cuban citizens, to pose as people who are trying to fight for rights and things like that. And so they'll assemble. Now, the Cuban, because of the longstanding fight or the longstanding tensions between the two countries, Cuba has enacted laws in its constitution that are really in strength and are more specific around acts of treason. Anyone who is working at the behest of the U.S. government and supporting these laws like Torricelli and Helms-Burton is able to be prosecuted under treason, laws of treason, and they have these particular things. And so in that, because the U.S. employs these people, once the Cuban government, something happened in 2003, I remember they locked up about 75 people who were fell into this category, not just locked them up. They actually had due process, but in the U.S., you were made to think that they didn't. And what we didn't understand was that these are pretty much political mercenaries acting on behalf of the U.S. And U.S. and all countries have laws against treason, but you're made to think that because they're coming down on people who are actually being employed to destabilize the country, that they're actually repressing people.
And this is a sort of standard formula we see in many Latin American countries who do try to crack down on foreign influenced actors to destabilize their regimes. Then they are accused of being authoritarian and dictatorial and undermining democracy.
Right. And it happens even with press. They'll employ people that pretend that they're journalists and they say, oh, they're cracking down on journalists, these kind of things. And, the Cuban people of here, I mean, I've been to Cuba several times and a lot of people have. And you can see that people are able to talk about things freely. They can assemble. Now, they have something like so one thing Trump said, something about political prisoners. And like you mentioned, the U.S. had imprisoned the Cuban Five. And we would be remiss if we didn't mention that there are a lot of political prisoners in the United States who've been in prison for a long time, since the time of COINTELPRO during the 60s and the 70s.
Absolutely.
And are still in prison.
Yeah, and we never, ever hear the U.S. leaders talking about them, the most high-profile political prisoners who have, been among the very few to actually receive some freedom. Was Chelsea Manning and Oscar Lopez Rivera, mm-hmm. but they're two out of many, many others, right?
and many, many others. I mean, how much of a slap in the face is it for even even the Obama administration not to give clemency to Leonard Peltier?
Mumia Abu-Jamal, and many others. Yeah.
I mean, and so these are the kind of double standards we're talking here. And in Cuba, it's fair to say we don't want to ignore them, make it seem like we're ignoring the issue of political prisoners there. But many of the people who really were locked up as political mercenaries committing treason are not locked up anymore. And in fact, April before last, when he traveled to Cuba, one of the journalists that was in the entourage was made a snarky question to Raul Castro, asking him about political prisoners and if they would consider releasing them. And so Raul Castro was able to smugly reply, "What political prisoners are you talking about? If you can name one of them, we will let them go today." And so that's because they know they've released a lot of the people, a lot of them, and who actually really were able to have much longer and harsher sentences than they gave them for the treason. But they released a lot of them a lot of times due to ailments and things like that on humanitarian grounds, which, you know, here you don't even get that. You get people completely dying in prison here, whether they're political prisoners or not, and they won't release people. So there's a large double standard here. We could talk about human rights abuses. Everybody knows that people are killed by the police in this country at a rate of almost 3 per day by law enforcement. And in Cuba, they don't have any such things happening. And it's not to say that the country's perfect. There's no perfect country. But as it stands in stark contrast to the reality and the picture that U.S. officials, and it's not really just Trump, but U.S. officials try to paint about the country. And not to mention, one last thing, they regard things like healthcare and education and those things as human rights. So when they talk about human rights here, things here that we don't really have and really are repressive policies in regards to that in this country, it's a stark contradiction and hypocrisy.
Absolutely. Cuban doctors are among the best trained in the world. Finally, right. One of the things, other things that Trump mentioned was this issue of investments, private investments, which I feel like is a really big one, particularly for Republicans. They, of course, and the U and many U.S. presidents for years have considered Cuba's communism as the main source of anathema, right? So what do you think Trump is holding Cuba to in terms of trade policy and economic policy? Essentially, the U.S. wants to see Cuba undo its economic system, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Now it's somewhat of it is hot air, it's hard to just focus on Trump. He's such a, when it comes to Cuba policy, right now he's the president. But this is typical of the capitalist politicians and whatnot that talk about Cuba is about the communism and the socialism. But you know, the United States has relationships with China, with Vietnam. I mean, that can't be really the crux of it. But I think what it is when it comes to Cuba is that it's an island that's only 90 miles away from the U.S. and has been able to withstand all manner of things and really upholds an example of a different society. So when they think of it and they're saying socialism, they're really talking about those things. Cuba is open to doing business with the United States or any country, but what they assert is that it has to be on their own terms. They're not going to subject themselves to like free trade agreements and structural adjustment programs from like the World Bank and the IMF and those kind of things. They want to ensure that their citizens are treated fairly when it comes to wages and tariffs and those kind of things. So Trump, and I think all of them, but also while Trump is saying this, there's a large business community that realizes this contradiction and doesn't really care. They see business opportunities with the country, whether they're socialist or not. And they're a socialist country. They call them communists, but those are just misunderstandings of these terms here. They don't really understand the distinctions between any of those things. But there's a large business community that wants to open up relations with Cuba and will do business. It's, for them, it's like better to do business with a communist country or a socialist country than to not do business at all and miss out on any kind of business deals you can get. But I think a large part of what Trump is doing. It really doesn't, it's somewhat of a childish move, and I think he's maybe even being manipulated by right-wingers like Marco Rubio and whatnot that want to reverse this stuff. But it's more like he's doing it because he said he could. When you think about business interests and those kind of things, there's nothing that an advisor to Trump and his administration can come up with to do to Cuba to get it to change that hasn't been done already.
Well, Netfa, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. I'm sure we'll be covering this story again in the coming months as it remains to be seen how the Cuba policy actually plays out. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
My guest is Netfa Freeman with the Institute for Policy Studies. He's an organizer at the International Committee for Peace, Justice, and Dignity, and has worked in the U.S.-Cuba Solidarity Movement. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo.